Welcome, everybody, to a very super special episode of Podcast Them Softly. I'm Frank, and I'm here with Nick.
What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. I have a feeling that this podcast may very well be the pinnacle of my life, so I'm very much looking forward to this. Joining us today on the show are Ken and Jim Wheat, and this is an extra special podcast for both Nick and I, because as children we were both totally obsessed with their amazing contribution to the Star Wars universe, Ewoks: The Battle for Endor. This was a film that we watched repeatedly throughout our youth, so to get a chance to speak with the guys who crafted this epic piece of cinema from our childhood is beyond thrilling. We promise not to like freak out too hard, but that's not a guarantee. So they have also been the creators of the widely successful Pitch Black universe, having scripted the first film in the stylish and gritty sci-fi series starring Vin Diesel. Other writing credits include The Silent Scream, The Fly 2, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, and directorial efforts, Lies, and the horror anthology After Midnight. Welcome to the show, guys. This is an immense honor to get to speak with you.
Well, we're pleased to have had you invite us.
And I want to give a special shout out to Steve DeJarnett, because he's the one who hooked us up with you guys, and we both freaked out on our podcast with him when he said that he knew you and he could ask if you guys were interested in coming on our show. So,
well, we were the ones who corrupted him back in college days.
Yeah, this is a definite treat. Thank you very much. As Frank said in the intro, Battle for Endor was it was one of the defining movies of my childhood. My sister and I watched that movie. I forced my sister to watch that movie. Not that she needed too much forcing, because she enjoyed it too, but I swear that tape was watched, rewound. It was one of those glorious, taped off of television, made by your mother video cassettes with the little Ewok sticker to, denote which movie it was. That way I could pull it off the shelf and pop it in. So this is really cool, and super excited to ask you questions that, I've long always wanted to know the answers to. So thank you guys very much for coming on.
Sure, it's our pleasure.
So I got to ask, how did you guys even get involved with this? What was the genesis of the Ewok movies and everything?
Well,
2 years after Jedi.
Well, the first Ewok movie we had nothing to do with. It was after Jedi was finished. They had all of these costumes and props and things left over, and George was setting up the ability to shoot things at the ranch, and had the ILM facilities at that time were in San Rafael. And so he decided to do a TV movie. It was additionally going to be 1 hour. And after they shot a 1 hour version, ABC said, well, if you make it 2 hours, we'll pay you three times as much for the licensing fee. So he went and shot a bunch of extra stuff, which is partly why that one's fairly episodic.
And he was also, he was frustrated when he was shooting Jedi. They would spend a lot of money building these big sets, and in the editing, he wouldn't like the way they look. So they would put together a little black painted section of the stage and do a matte painting, and shoot the shot over again in Marin for practically nothing. So he was interested in seeing just how cheaply you could make a Star Wars movie. And that was great for us, because we had just finished our first film, Lies, and we had been trying to get in touch with the Amblin people. They were doing TV stuff, and we're looking for young directors. And they had passed along a tape of Lies to the folks at Lucasfilm. And so we hadn't even gotten our film out when we were getting a call to.
And the call that we got was, we were at that time cutting together a trailer for Lies to try and get theatrical release. And at that point, the only phone calls we got were from people that we owed money to. And there was this message on our answering machine that said, "This is Tom Smith at Lucasfilm. Give me a call." And so we were figuring, how can we owe them money? And then we finally figured out that, well, it must be somebody who was a crew member on Lies, wanted us, you know, had put us down as a reference. That was the only thing we could think of.
And so the next thing we knew, we were being flown up to Northern California and meeting with George, and we were very lucky in being chosen to direct it. And he was trying to see how cheaply he could do a Star Wars movie, and it was a lot more money than we had ever had to work with before. And being released on ILM and an incredible wealth of talent up there, from designers to production people to the mad artist to everything. Plus, he had acres of storage full of just about everything they had used shooting the Star Wars movies. And so we were given a fair amount of latitude to just come up with whatever we could to put together a new Ewok adventure.
Well, before we flew up there, because it was literally, we flew up maybe 2 days, I think, after we got the call. And in the meantime, it was a desperate search first to find a tape of the first Ewok movie, because at that time it obviously hadn't come out yet. It would had been on TV just a couple of months before. So anyway, we found somebody at ABC who was able to get us a 3/4-inch tape of it, and then we had to find a 3/4-inch machine, and we watched it and weren't overly impressed with it. But on the flight up, we just talked about what films we liked when we were kids.
And thinking about adventure movies, the Swiss Family Robinson and Treasure Island and
Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and things like that. And so we kind of walked in without any prep of any kind and sat down with George and talked about, you know,
how you make interesting stories that will appeal to kids and adults. And the first thing he said is, "I want this to be all about death." he had just a few nights before sat down with his daughter Amanda and watched Heidi, and he really liked the old grandfather character.
Well, also, he had a 5-year-old daughter at that time. Yeah. And so it was, he was interested in kind of dumping the rest of the family characters and just having it be about Sindel.
And so we said, yeah, we could do that. So we basically worked with George and Joe Johnston and some of the other key people up there, Tom Smith, kicking around ideas for the story. We knew that it was sort of going to pick up where the other movie left off. And
it was basically just 2 4-hour long story sessions, and the entire story was worked out, which we had never done anything like that. It was kind of in some ways weird, because he would go, "Okay, that's fine. You know, there'll be this little creature. Okay, but the little creature will move around fast."
And he wanted the villains to be really big, since the Ewoks are small. So the designer started working on that. And it's, you know, it's a fairly simple story, and people die and people go on an adventure and everybody lives happily ever after, except those who die.
So we jumped in for the first 6 weeks or so. We were flying up 2 or 3 times a week on commuter flights, fly up to Oakland, rent a car, drive up to Lucasfilm and work with the designers also looking for locations, which were almost entirely on the ranch, except for two redwood forest areas that were right near the ranch.
And wow. It was interesting because we were dealing with really incredible designers, and they would spend all week just drawing whatever came into their mind. And then we would take everything up to George's office and lay everything out, and he had three stamps. One was could be better, one was trash, and the other one was okay. And he would just go through and look and stamp that a little okay or trash.
And it wasn't trash, it was 86.
86.
Throw it out.
So it was really interesting to watch how they all work together. And it's really an evolution of concepts, getting closer and closer to what George's vision was.
And while this was all going on, the story had been locked in right away, right when we had first gone up, and they hired a writer to write the script. And on April 1st was our first day when we had, you know, taken U-Haul trailers up with our stuff to stay for 6 months. And that day the script came in, and it was gloom and doom.
Now, I remember walking into the office, and Tom and Joe Johnston were sitting on the couch, and they looked at us, and they looked like death warmed over. And we read the script, and it was like a really bad Star Trek episode. And we all knew that if George read it, they'd just shut everything down.
Yeah, Joe was convinced that if George ever saw this script, the project would be canceled.
But Tom Smith turned to us and he said, well, you guys are writers. You can write the script. And so instead of spending the first couple of weeks...
It was 1 week.
They locked us in a motel room and we banged out a script. And we were having meetings with the storyboard artists. And we would kick around sequences, and then they would draw up the storyboards, and then we'd take the storyboards and sort of describe them in script form. And there were large sections of the script that were written like that. But it flowed together, and we got a script together, and George liked the script, so we went ahead and shot the movie.
This is amazing, and you know we're trying to process all of this, and I just want to ask. So Joe Johnston was one of the collaborators in the creative process.
Absolutely, yeah. He was awesome.
Big Joe Johnston's work, and I've read online that he was one of the guys that was like one of the key people to work on Boba Fett. Like he was right. I don't know if you guys know that.
He was. Oh yeah, he was behind a lot of things that happened from the beginning. He had just come out of USC during the
out of Long Beach?
Oh, maybe, yeah. And it was during the first Star Wars, and he was like 21 years old, and I think came on just as a PA doing sketches and doing this and that, and ended up having a big creative role from the beginning, and then a huge creative role on Empire and Jedi. And wow. probably should have directed this one, but...
Well, he basically was the production designer, and so he was involved in a huge part of the look of it with his team. And he directed the second unit, which was basically him and a cameraman and a small team, and they would go off every day and just shoot shots of things blowing up and
yeah, all the
people running through the forest.
All the marauder action stuff was, we were working from very strict storyboards and the script, and it had to be very carefully planned day by day because it was a huge amount of material to do, and we were also dealing with kids. So with
three of our four main actors were minors, so we only had them for so many hours a day, and Sindel we only had for literally a couple of hours after lunch. And so we had another little girl that was a stand-in. So if you're not seeing Sindel's face, you're seeing the stand-in. And we were able to sort of work it so we were able to get most of our work done every day.
And meanwhile, Joe was off having fun blowing things up.
Oh my God. I can't even process this. This is just so amazing.
Well, it was a weird way to make a movie, but it was sort of Lucas's way to make a movie.
And it was, he wanted to see how cheaply he could do effects. So we did a lot of things that were basically effect techniques from the 30s
and 20s.
A lot of it was with matte paintings, where we would block off half the frame and shoot the scene, and then we'd roll the film back and block off the other half of the frame and put the matte painting in.
So it was in the camera opposed to
optically printing.
Yeah, doing it afterwards. And the same thing also, we did some hanging miniatures and in the camera splits to double the number of marauders, and, you know, putting the castle on the hill where it was really just 10 feet in front of the camera on a platform, and having a black card in front of the lens that you then move, take away the platform and the castle and put the black card on the top half and wind the film back and run it again.
And hope that everything's in focus.
Which it usually was. Yeah. and also the stop motion animation, which Phil Tippett brilliantly did, was old-fashioned Harryhausen style. They had developed the go motion technique that's what they used on, for instance, on Empire, all of the big snow battle, anything that was stop motion. They had a technique where part of the problem with stop motion is it's frozen frames. So when you're running together 24 frozen frames, it doesn't have that natural blur that real action that you film has. So go motion, they would shoot a frame and then do a movement to create a blur that would be an in-between movement, and then shoot the next frame. And this instead was the old-fashioned shoot a frame, move the armature, shoot another frame. Which
and shake the table while you're doing it to give it the blur.
It's why the beast, which actually Joe had apparently been trying for years to get a flying whale into a Star Wars movie, and this was sort of a compromise on the flying whale.
Oh my God! How long was the shoot for this film?
Well, which shoot?
I would say encompassing of the whole project.
Well, we started in April and we were done by the middle of summer. But we shot the film and we did our cut.
It was like 5 weeks of principal photography.
And then we did our cut of the film, and then George would come in and sit with us. And he would take a grease pencil and sit and just about every shot, he would say, cut it here and cut it here. And we can lose this and we can lose that.
And we need a big action.
Well, basically, we got down and we said, George, if you cut too much more, we're not going to have a long enough picture for ABC. And he said, don't worry about that. And so he kept cutting. And we said, well, it's now about 10 minutes short. And he said, well, we really need some other kind of scene in here. And maybe something with hang gliders.
And a dragon.
And a dragon. And we said, okay. And Joe went off, and the next day came back with a storyboard of the dragon in the cave sequence. And we went ahead and built sets for that, and there were dozens of other little pickup shots and pieces to fill in and make scenes work a little bit better. So we did another 2 weeks, and it turned out that Tom Smith, the producer, knew about George's method of making films, which is essentially the old studio way of making films. You shoot it, you cut it, you look at it, and then you fix it. And so he had budgeted in an additional hunk of money for the George factor. And it was great for us because it allowed us to fix a lot of things that, you know, we were just making compromises that you were trying to get through the production. And it gave us a real opportunity to make it a tighter and better film.
Wow.
And then we went back into the editing room,
yeah.
Which was, that's when we spent the most time with George. He loves editing. He was hardly around at all during, well, as Jim was talking about with pre-production, we would get together just for 2 hours, maybe twice a week, if that, where it would be just, you know, his little stamps to decide which designs he liked better. And other than that, we had one meeting about the script before we started shooting. But then once we were full into editing, he was there every day. He really enjoyed that.
And on the first Ewok movie, he would take reels up to his house at night and then bring them back the next day, cut with supermarket grocery bags full of trims and clips of film that were sort of freaking the editors out, worrying about losing too much film.
Well, one of the fun things we did as we were getting closer to the end of the editing is, and I think it was George who suggested, he said, you know, we have all of these bits and pieces of outtake from Empire Strikes Back. Return of the Jedi, the battle with the Ewoks against the Stormtroopers. And he said, you know, you're welcome to use any shots that were done then.
So we basically went through all the outtakes of those scenes.
But none of it was organized at all. It was just all in little tiny rolls of a few feet of film. There was no way to figure out what anything was other than just to open up these little rolls and hold them up and say, oh, okay, here's a shot that's an Ewok shooting an arrow. And
here's a shot of an Ewok blowing a trumpet. And so we were able to sort of expand our battle sequence with all these clips from Star Wars that were a little bit higher production value.
Now, you guys came into all of this as Star Wars fans, Star Wars aficionados, Star Wars, what was your, you know, overall emotional relationship to the material?
We were big fans.
We had been huge fans of THX and American Graffiti, and we actually wrangled an invitation to a party in Marin that John Cordy, who was a buddy of George's, was throwing. And George was at the party and was sitting around talking about how it was after American Graffiti, and we asked him what he was working on. He was talking about, well, this is sort of a space Western. And we talked about it for a few minutes.
I remember particularly he said, And it'll have a lot of Flash Gordon. They'll have capes and they'll have sword fights, except they'll be laser swords. But he was really bummed out because Universal was totally disinterested, even though American Graffiti had made them $100 million.
But we were really excited about it. And then when the first Star Wars came out, our entertainment attorney was in the same firm as George's attorneys, and they were having the cast and crew screening. And our attorney said, would you be interested in going to the cast and crew screening? And we said, absolutely. And so we went and saw Star Wars with the cast and crew who were seeing it for the first time. And they started the screening with the Warner Brothers Duck Dodgers in the 21st century, and the Martian character, and everybody loved that. And then the first shot of the film of the starship coming in and getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the crowd was just going nuts for it. And so it was probably the best way to see Star Wars, with everybody seeing it for the first time. Nobody really had, there wasn't any media out there. And I somehow,
and at that time, the studio had not been supported. And
yeah, I somehow ended up going to dinner with a group of people that included some of the Fox accounting department people and some of the studio people. And they were sitting there going, we're screwed. This is going to just tank and we're going to lose all this money. And I sat there going, did you just see the film that I just saw? Because this is going to be a huge hit. I'd never seen anything like it. And
they were upset that George had talked them into putting out an extra, I think it was maybe $25,000 to shoot the additional shots for the cantina scene, because that had not turned out well during the initial shoot. So he got in Rick Baker and a bunch of other friends to come up with
some other creatures,
interesting creatures, the little band, and a lot of the individual shots of creatures at the bar. All of those were done at the last minute. And these Fox guys thought, what a waste of money. It doesn't change that scene at all.
Jeez.
And this is after they've seen the movie now. And we also had been about a year before, or 8 months before, we knew somebody who was working in the warehouse over in Van Nuys where they were shooting the effects.
Yeah, the first ILM building.
Yeah, and we went over and saw them shooting some motion control shots
of the spaceships.
And which was fascinating because it was just, you know, doing it a frame at a time and moving around pieces of blue screen, not even blue screen, blue cardboard to be behind a TIE fighter that they would then later have a rotoscope slave go through frame by frame and clean everything else out. And they were at that time building the model of the Star Cruiser, which was basically a bunch of people sitting in a big room with the model in a raw condition, just was a big made out of plastic. And they had all these model kits, tanks and airplanes and
cars
and different things, and just pulling out little bits and pieces from the model kits and gluing them on to give it texture and size. And they also had several Death Stars, one with a trench big enough to move the camera down into it, and another one that was maybe 25 yards across that had a curve to it that was for the wider shots. And that was, so we knew just, I mean, we knew from the first time hearing that George was going to be doing this kind of movie, we knew it was going to be great.
Yeah, because if you look at THX and the short version of THX that he did originally, which was he had been hired at USC to teach a filmmaking class to these guys who were in the Navy. And it was sort of a Navy program to teach these guys how to do, you know, educational films or whatever the Navy needed. And he said, well, let's go make a movie. And they used the USC camera equipment, and the Navy guys were his crew, and they went out and shot a 15-minute version of THX. And it's just a mind-blowing film for a basically no-budget film.
Well, and the feature version, which was $700,000.
Yeah, is an amazing film.
Yeah, that is. That film's, I can't even believe all this. I can't even believe you guys saw, like, the first screening ever and everything. This is just, well, my mind is blowing.
And the next time around, when the Empire Strikes Back came out, we wanted to go see the screening they were having there, and we sort of talked to our attorney's office, and they said, we don't think we can get you into that. But we had we had a friend who was working on the Fox lot, and he got us a pass to drive on to the lot. So we drove in with our wives, and the plan was to, if our name wasn't on the list, we'd just go, it must be some mistake, because our attorney said it would, we would be on the list. And we got in line, and we're going up, and they were checking everybody's driver's license, including Harrison Ford. And at that point, we realized that there's no way we're
going to be. And we got to the front of the line and said, oh, it must be some kind of mistake. Maybe it was written on later, and said, no, this is a type list. Yeah. Nobody is penciled in.
Yeah. So fortunately, we didn't make too big a stink.
No, we turned and
humbly walked away.
Walked away, and our wives were pretty pissed off at us.
That's incredible. I can't believe all this. So at that point, you guys obviously would have no idea that one day you're going to be directing and writing one of the Ewok films.
No,
right?
Not at all.
There's like no way.
We were still trying to figure out how to get our own movies made.
Right.
And so it was a couple of years before we were able to get that together. And then the timing just worked out that we had a piece of film that we could show, and we were non-DGA. He was specifically looking for non-union directors because he had quit the Directors Guild when they said he couldn't put his name at the end of the films. He had to put it.
That he couldn't do the end title, you know, all the titles at the end the way everybody does it now. But because it said Lucasfilm Limited as the opening card, the DGA said, well, then Irving Kirshner has to be at the front also. And
the writers and the director.
And everybody else.
And George said, no, I'll be the first credit at the end, not the last credit at the very beginning. And they went back and forth on this, and they said, no, you can't do it. The rules are the rules. And so he said, okay, I quit. And so he couldn't use a DGA director at that time. He's since made up with the Directors Guild. And we were non-DGA and stayed non-DGA. And because we were hired to write the film after the first writer screwed up, that got us into the Writers Guild. And
got us a huge payment of $15,000 for our script.
Yeah.
But then again, we only worked a week on the script.
Yeah.
Now, how did you guys, how did the overall entertainment business start for you guys? Where did you, you know, was it film school? And then, you know, what's the background?
Well, essentially, we both went to Occidental College. Ken was a junior when I arrived as a freshman. And I came down as a biology pre-med student. And Ken was in the drama department and had already made a decision to go into the movie making. And the people he hung out with were a lot more fun than the people I hung out with in the biology department, who just studied all the time and took school very seriously. And so by the end of my sophomore year, I had switched over and become a drama major. And We wrangled a grant to make a educational film, and I spent part of my junior year traveling around with Ken shooting a documentary about why Native American kids should go to college. And then we started working on a short film that Ken had in mind, and I'll let him tell that part of the story.
Okay, well, basically, we decided, you know, it was kind of the obvious thing was to make a short to show, you know, something that's like a feature but isn't a feature, because there weren't indie features other than exploitation films at that time. And there also were very few ways for younger aspiring people to get into Hollywood.
Roger Corman's production company was about the only way. And so a lot of the people who were coming up at about the same time as we were coming up through Roger Corman.
But instead, and that was kind of intimidating. So I started doing this short. Jim was around for part of it, but he was also involved in a screenwriting program
on the East Coast.
Yeah, that
with Frank Danielle, who was the head of AFI for a number of years. He had run the Czech filmmaking school before coming to America, and it was a fabulous course on writing. So,
and the short was done over the period of about 9 months, partly because it had a lot of big sets and fairly complicated elements. It took place in a Hollywood backlot and studio environment and in the 1920s. And a lot of the backlot was actually Occidental College, where I had gone and Jim had just graduated. And a friend of ours from high school, who went on to become both a screenwriter and a novelist, Dave Madsen, who wrote the film Copycat. Did you ever see that with Sigourney Weaver?
Sigourney Weaver and Harry Connick Jr.
Yeah. And was it Sigourney Weaver or Holly Hunter? I can't remember either. Anyway, Dave also worked on it, and it was basically a huge amount of time and effort.
And part of it was it would take a while to sort of scrape together the money so we could build sets. And then it would take a while to scrape together the money so we could shoot the stuff with the cars. And so it was sort of done piecemeal. But when it was finished, it turned out really well and went on the sort of festival circuit and won some prizes.
And I just recently was cleaning my office and found a letter from Walter Murch, who had been a judge at the Marin County Film Festival, which is one of the places where it won several prizes. And he said in this letter that it was one of the best short films he'd ever seen. So that was very nice to look back and realize that someone who was already a hero to us because of his involvement in THX and went on, of course, to do Apocalypse Now and other amazing things. So I had totally forgotten that he had been one of the judges on that. Anyway, we decided, okay, so we'll make a feature.
And the first feature we were trying to put together, we had an idea for sort of a science fiction thing, and it was back when you could get tax credits that made it easier to finance things, and so we were putting that together, and we had hooked up with a bunch of the people from Taxi Driver, and Michael Chapman was going to be the DP, and it was going to be directed by David Nichols, who was one of the creative consultants on Taxi Driver, and
the cast was Harvey Keitel and Sarah Miles and Christopher Lee.
But just before we were able to get it off the ground, the Congress changed the tax law, and the money basically disappeared. You couldn't get the tax credit, so our investor really didn't have any reason to invest the full amount. He was willing to invest 10% and then write everything off through bank loans. But when we were done with it and it was falling apart, he said, well, you know, I was willing to spend, you know, $100,000. If you find something you can do for $100,000, I'll still do that. And again, our entertainment attorney was also in the firm where Martin Scorsese was a client. And Martin Scorsese was looking around for some money to do a documentary. He was doing these character studies. He did one on his parents, and he wanted to do one on one of his assistants, a guy named Stephen Price.
Prince.
And so our attorneys put us together, and we put up the money, and they went off and made this film. So our first producing credit was on a Scorsese film. So our resume was starting to look a little more realistic.
But one of the other problems with that failed project was that at the, about the same time that the money fell apart, we had felt that we weren't good enough writers yet to do the script. So we had hired somebody else to do the script who turned out to be a much worse writer than us.
Yeah. As well as being a junkie.
A minor detail.
And he had blown the money that we had spent, and we had told our investor that, you know, even if the movie falls apart, we'll be able to maybe sell the script. But we had a script that was totally unsellable. So that was the first time we sat down to actually write something. And we put together a script, and we ended up selling it for a few thousand dollars to one of the schlock masters in Hollywood.
I'm sure you guys have heard of Graydon Clark, known for such great films as Without Warning and
Black Shampoo
and Satan's Cheerleaders.
Oh.
These are some fine movies. So he took this movie that we were planning to make a very classy, low budget, but very classy, low budget science fiction movie, and he made a very unclassy science fiction movie that was shot in 15 days. And the parts that were Harvey Keitel and Sarah Miles and Christopher Lee. Originally, he was talking about Mike Connors in the Harvey Keitel part, and we were, because he would, all his movies, he would use old Hollywood actors who he could get really cheap. And we said, no, no, come on, spend a little more money on your cast and get younger people that can draw an audience. So we hired Sybil Shepherd and Jan Michael Vincent, but then still made this really schlocky, quickie movie that, and Raymond Burr played the Christopher Lee part, doing all of his lines off of cue cards and shot his entire part in a day. So it's a really bad movie.
And a number of years ago, we found that first draft of that script that we had been using as sort of a calling card to get work. And we read it and were just mortified that we had actually shown that script to other people because it was really terrible. But fortunately, we learned a fair amount.
Well, actually, before we sold it, we had written about five more drafts of it. The very first draft, we didn't have a clue how to write. There were no books on how to write a screenplay, and we hadn't been to USC.
And this was before computers, so everything was being written out longhand, and then we'd hire a typist. And then to do the second draft, we'd sort of clip out scenes that were sort of okay and cut and paste the script onto legal pads and have her retype everything.
But then around that time, I went to my 10th high school reunion, which was a horrifying experience. And I came back and said, here's the next script we need to do, Reunion with Death. And it was basically 10 little Indians set at a high school reunion. And we decided that we wrote the script and we were going to do that. But in the meantime, that script
Well, we actually had gone ahead and shot one of the sequences.
No, but before that we did Silent Scream.
Oh, yeah.
It was, the script was seen by Denny Harris, and we got hired to come in and put together, he needed to shoot an extra 20 minutes of this movie, and we ended up shooting an extra all but 12 minutes. And we used about 12 minutes of the original footage and made a new movie out of it. It turned out well. And from that, we were able to raise some money to do a sequence from
The Reunion with Death, where a guy gets hung underneath an elevator in the hotel where the reunion is taking place. So we built this probably five stories of an elevator shaft lying on its side in an old abandoned supermarket, and then created this rig that our actor would hang in and sort of twirl around as it, we moved him up and down the shaft underneath this elevator set. And we shot that, and we used that sequence of film to go around and start raising money, and we got a cable deal and a video cassette deal based on that. And we were just about to get ready to go on that when National Lampoon's Class Reunion came out. And it was basically a comedy version of a mystery set at a high school reunion. And we went, oh, we can't do our film now. But we went back to the cable people and said, if we do another film that uses this sequence, will you still give us the deal for the cable rights? And they said, sure. So we sort of scrambled around and came up with another idea for an entirely different movie that had this elevator sequence in it.
So instead of being in a hotel, it was an elevator in a hospital. And instead of one of the reunioneers, it was a young doctor at the hospital who gets hung below the elevator. And so in the in that film, that was Lies. And in the final film, the full 10-minute sequence is in there just exactly as it was, as we shot it for
the other movie.
The other movie. And while we were doing this elevator sequence, the kid who swept the floors and was the sort of studio stagehand, this was at Raleigh Studios, although I think it was still called Producer's Studio then, was Kevin Costner. And
he said, I'd love to be in this movie when you get around to making it. And we said, well, we really need to get somebody with a little name recognition.
So we didn't use Kevin.
So we didn't use Kevin, and much to our later regret, but oh well.
That's showbiz.
Right. So how did you guys conceive the idea of Pitch Black?
Well, what we had been working with Interscope on another script. We wrote a sort of a werewolf movie that ended up not getting made, but they liked it. And one of the producers called us in to a meeting and said, we're thinking about doing a movie of a sort of space movie, a planet with two suns, and there's an eclipse, and it turns out that it's a haunted planet. So there are these ghosts. Do you think you could come up with something? And we said, sure, yeah, that sounds, I've never seen a haunted planet movie before. So we sort of kicked around some ideas, and basically we said, you know, this is essentially a chance to redo Stagecoach. A ragtag group of desperate characters thrown together, and you're stuck in the middle of the desert, and instead of Indians, it's aliens that are attacking you.
Well, and it was also equal parts of the movie Five Came Back, which was a plane that crashes in the Amazon jungle and again has a prisoner and bounty hunter, and some of the people are going to die and some of them are going to make it out away. And it was combining a whole bunch of different, you know, sort of, it was a stock and always good idea of having the bad guy ending up having to help the good guys and having the bounty hunter who isn't such a good guy and these different elements.
And we turned in the script and they they liked it, but at that point, the producer who had hired us had moved on to another job, and so the folks at Interscope called us in and said, we really like this, but we really don't like the ghosts. Could it be something else? And we said, well, you know, they come out in the dark, they go through walls, they're ghosts. And they said, yeah, but we don't like ghosts. Can you do something else?
Can they be creatures? It can be everything, can be pretty much the same, but creatures instead of ghosts.
And okay, fine. As a screenwriter, you learn to say yes. Yes, sir. and so we rewrote it as aliens. And then they went off and were trying to put it together, and we didn't hear about it for a long time. And we got a call from Interscope saying, would you like to come see a screening of the film?
No, actually, we knew before then that they were making it. But
so we went and saw it, and it was next to the Star Wars screening, one of the best screenings. You know, there are some films that we've worked on that I still haven't seen because it's so painful to watch. But this, David Tuohy did a fabulous job of shooting it down in Australia, and he made some significant changes that really helped it and created the opportunity to use Vin Diesel. And
because Vin Diesel wouldn't have been in it if it had been based on our script, because his character was a woman in our version.
Sort of this kick-ass prisoner female. But it was one of the most satisfying screenings because it was as close to what our vision had been, but done by David, which, you know, his vision was really unique, and he did a great job. And
but again,
was
it almost
terrific.
It almost didn't get released theatrically because USA Films, which was a division of USA Network, was falling apart, and Interscope was falling apart, and PolyGram had bought Interscope, and all this stuff was going on, and it was basically going to go direct to video. And fortunately, Harry Knowles, who at that time had just had Ain't It Cool News for a couple of years.
All this. This is totally crazy. I remember all this is awesome stuff.
Because he championed it, and literally it was because of that that they kind of went, maybe this isn't so bad.
And they managed to get a trailer for it, one of the first ads on the Super Bowl, and it came out, and it was very successful. It helped Vin's career, and they've gone on and made the other two films, and we're hoping they'll make another one. It can keep going and going as long as Vin wants to make them.
Except that Riddick didn't do too well.
Did you guys ever expect that series to have the life that it's had? I can remember seeing the first one opening weekend in New York City in Times Square with a buddy. And I remember that we had like no expectations. We didn't really know what to expect. We'd kind of heard about this movie that was supposed to be under the radar a little bit, low budget, gritty, kind of scary. And I remember walking out and just being like, wow, that was awesome. And I was like, just like the kind of, you know, elevated B movie that, you know, Hollywood doesn't seem to make a lot of times anymore. And, you know, David, I've always wondered how to say the guy's last name. It's Tuohy.
Tuohy.
Yeah, David Tuohy's had a great career out of making these under the radar, you know, little like genre gems, like, you know, The Arrival. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was another really fun.
Yeah, The Arrival's awesome. Film.
And the submarine movie
Below.
Yeah, Below is so underrated. I remember when that was like originally like a Darren Aronofsky project in some way, and you know, Tuohy was involved, and he all of his stuff always has like this sort of this unique like credibility to it.
He's really good with working with actors and getting the characters to come alive.
The thing that was a little bit of a problem, though, was he kind of, with Chronicles of Riddick, got too big.
It was blown up way.
He turned it into Dune,
And that was unfortunate because it ended up being very expensive. It went way over budget. And it made more than Pitch Black, but it cost 8 times as much. So that was why it took so long for Riddick to come out.
And Riddick wouldn't have come out at all, except Vin went on to make the Fast and the Furious movies. And they said, would you make one more? And he said, will you give me the rights to Pitch Black? And so he made a deal for a year to try and get the Riddick project going. And it was purely based on Universal's desire to keep Vin involved in the Fast and the Furious. And he went out and pre-sold it with foreign investors, and they went off and made it up in Canada, where it's basically mostly in front of green screen.
All of it.
Yeah.
Nothing was exterior. They at one time were talking about shooting it in Egypt and various other actual places like Pitch Black, but for financial reasons and just to keep the cost down, they did it entirely on stages with sets and partial, you know, like some rocks and then the rest.
The 300.
That basic deal.
Well, it looks much more, it was not attempting to make a stylized thing. It was attempting to be realistic, so to speak.
And I enjoyed it. I thought, it was fun because, you know, it got back to a much simpler.
Yeah, it brought it back.
Story.
One of the things that both Tui and Vin Diesel insisted upon was that it be R-rated, which Universal was very much against. But some movies should be R-rated.
Yes.
The integrity of the material. I mean, that was one of the other good things about it, is that it was this gritty, low-budget, R-rated science fiction movie that was different and it had an edge. And obviously when the second one got as expensive as it did and they saw the scope that it was, I'm sure that that played a big part in them not – I don't know if they even attempted to get an R rating on the second one. But, yeah, I mean, once
they absolutely, from the very beginning, it was decided that it would be PG-13. There was no
– Okay, so
– Studios don't make big-budget movies that are R-rated.
Unfortunately, you're right. There's very few in this day and age that happen to be R-rated that have big budgets. So I guess when those movies do come around, hopefully people go and check them out if they're worth seeing. But yeah, absolutely. And I would have to assume, again, that when they saw what they had after the DVD sales and the first film's success, they basically said, oh, wow, like, you know, here's a new franchise and let's beef it up, because that's what, you know, at least from where we're sitting, the studios love to do is set up franchises and as many, you know, movies that they can, you know, pump out in the summer and turn a big profit. But the fun thing about that movie is that, you know, it had a phrase is, but the first movie has sort of like that, in the first, an Alien, like the working class feeling to the people on the ship.
Well, yeah. one of the things that was most important for us with the script was that it's not that far in the future. It's, which is why there's a character who collects antiques from our era. You know, he has a bottle of 20th century whiskey and he has antique furniture. And it was one of the things that was so weird when Chronicles of Riddick came out, and it was kind of like, I don't know, thousands of years in the future, as far as I could tell.
But the middle part of the film where he goes and breaks out the prisoner, I thought was a really exciting, visually.
And outrunning the sun.
Yeah. It was. It had its moment.
Oh, sorry. I did not mean to interrupt. No. But no. Well, and while we're sort of, you know, bouncing around, talking about some of the credits, and I know we'll probably want to get back to Ewoks too, but you do have a credit, because I've never been a huge horror guy. Horror movies have sort of been selective for me. But when I was younger, I did happen to watch all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and I can't help but notice that you guys are credited as writing, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, but not necessarily under your name.
Now, the story behind that is it was one of the first projects we did after the Ewok movie, and we were hired to write the script, and we did the first draft. And
well, we were rewriting.
Yeah,
they had a couple of drafts that weren't working,
so we were rewriting it.
But they had a release date was their problem.
Yeah, and they had the director Rennie was on, so we were working with Rennie on, you know, getting the script together, and they were taking a long time to give us notes on the first draft that we did, and we said, you know, guys, if we're going to do another draft, we need to hurry up because there's going to be a writer's strike. And the New Line people said, well, what writer's strike? And we said, well, it's read the newspapers. It's going to happen. And so they finally said, okay, go ahead and do a second draft. And we got maybe halfway through and there was a strike. So we stopped writing. During the strike, which went on and on, they finished writing it and they were passing around the script with our name on it. And we said, you know, you can't do that. We didn't write during the strike. And so you can't be showing
and there
that
were
was
all
clearly
these,
done.
There were all these warnings that if you worked during the strike, we had finally just gotten into the guild and it's like you'll be thrown out of the guild forever.
So we were saying, don't do that. And then they went off and shot the film and we asked if we could see it because the scripts we had read just prior to production were a little funky. And Rennie said, no, I can't have a screening where there's negative energy. And so we said, well, you know, we either get to see it or we'll take a pseudonym. And so we ended up using a pseudonym and it turned out to be the biggest hit on our resume. So go figure.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, you know, as was it William Goldman, no one knows anything in Hollywood.
Yeah. And that has always been true and still is true.
Exactly.
Because we had actually just before that done The Fly 2, which again was a quickie where with that one they needed to have a script or it was going to get canceled. And that was done very quickly, but it was so much fun because Mel Brooks was the producer and he was just a riot to work with.
And he didn't take any shit from the studio people. We'd go into these studio meetings with Scott Rudin was running Fox at the time. And he would start making comments about the script. And Mel would just explode and yell and scream at him and saying, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm not going to let you ruin this film of mine. And then we would walk out of the meeting and go, oh, man, we're really glad you were there, Mel. And he said, oh, I just love being operatic.
And he would be laughing. So that was a fun one.
So I know you guys kind of touched upon this prior to us recording, but do you think that, well, I should say Disney now is going to perhaps release the Ewok films?
Beats me.
I hope they do. Out of all the films that we've worked on, and in every case you have a, you know, back end percentage, the Ewok movie is the only film that we've actually seen a net profit participation. And that's because George is very straightforward and his books are open. And now that Disney has taken over, we hope that they will continue to be transparent.
Well, plus, it's a fun movie for kids. I still think it holds up pretty well.
Yeah.
And if they would release it in the correct format, that would help.
That would be wonderful. And in this day and age of special editions galore and every movie under the sun getting a Blu-ray 25th anniversary, 30th anniversary thing, there could be far more, you know, esoteric titles out there than the, you know, Battle for Endor. That, I mean, it's long overdue. I'll just put it to you that way. And to get,
I can't imagine they wouldn't release it in some gigantic Star Wars suite.
Disney is a company that was built on the fact that they figured out that they could re-release their films every five years. And, you know, their early films, other than Snow White, were not financially successful. But over the course of multiple releases, Bambi and Cinderella and all those films became huge profit centers.
Not that this will be a huge profit center for them, but it's, I mean, they've released other things.
And they can put an Ewok ride in at Disneyland when they do the Star Wars.
Well, I know that Frank and I have been wondering, you know, with the new Star Wars, you know, sequels coming out, when and if we will see any Ewoks involved in any of them. And certainly if the species of creature is reignited in the franchise.
Oh, dude, Wicket's going to be in Force Awakens, I promise.
That's what I've heard rumors about. I mean, we know that Warwick worked on it.
Yeah, we've seen his name in the credits, but they've hidden who his name is. Like, you can see it on the IMDb, but they're not telling you who he is. So there's everybody's speculating that he, you know, but then again, is Warwick playing somebody else? So, but you never know.
Yeah. Who knows?
But yeah, getting a Blu-ray, a proper Blu-ray or DVD or just anything with, you know, in the appropriate widescreen and cleaned up. I mean, it's just so much fun, those movies. And like the, you know, I've long been fascinated with the Teak character, I have to say, because it was like the fast running Ewok.
Well, so. actually Teak is an interesting story because Teak started out as a puppet. Teak was not a little person in an outfit initially.
We had a reasonably short pre-production, and the creature crew was working around the clock creating a mechanical puppet that would be operated by three or four people. And they finished it up, and on one of our first days of shooting, we tried working with it. And it just wasn't working, and it was taking too long, and we were working with this minor actor and said, we can't take hours trying to get a shot. We have to be able to do this very quickly. And they said, well, you know, this is the best we can do. And at that moment, one of the actors playing one of the Ewoks, one of the smallest Ewoks, was standing next to the puppet, and we all realized that the puppet wasn't much smaller than this actress. So we said, can you create a costume for Nikki? And they said, yeah, we could do that. And they basically put together a costume really quickly overnight with a head that was not particularly articulated. And so we started shooting some of the wider shots
and over the shoulders.
Over the shoulders, while they worked on an articulated mechanical face that had the expressions and all of that stuff. So those scenes were shot with Nikki in the costume, but wires going in and out of the costume so that the ears would wiggle and the eyes would go up and down and smile.
And actually, there are a few shots in the movie that have the puppet. The first scene with Noah and Teak when Wicket and Sindel are outside, some of the wide shots have the puppet. And it was also, the additional problem was that we had a very, very grumpy man playing the grumpy old man. And that made it extremely difficult.
How did Wilford Brimley, how was Wilford Brimley in an Ewok movie? I need to know that.
Well, we basically wanted him. George wanted to make a space version of Heidi, And we said, well, if you want a cantankerous old coot, Will Brimley's your man. But we didn't really know anything more about him than what we had seen of him in the films. We didn't know that he is a method actor to the nth degree. And we would have these scenes set up where we say, okay, well, now you come around this rock and you look up at that castle. What castle? Well, we'll put the castle in later. It's just up over here. I don't see a castle. Well, just look up here over here. I don't see a castle. I'm not going to. And we have a scene where we said, okay, now you're watching Teak run out, and we were on a set on the stage, and he said, I don't see anything. And, well, it's the character. We'll put it in later.
We'll have the exterior.
We'll shoot that later. So you want me to look at something I can't see? I can't do that. So we had our assistant director put a lambskin coat on and sort of prance around outside. And
so just to get him to look out the door at something.
Yeah.
Oh my!
Otherwise,
God.
He would just stand there.
And we were later talking to some of the people who worked on The Natural, and they said, "Oh man, we could have told you that." They had a scene where the hero hits a home run, and they said, "Okay, now we're going to get your close-up, Will, of you reacting to the home run." And
so, when they shot a take, and he didn't do anything, and they said, "Well, react to it," and they shot another take.
He didn't do anything. He said, "Will, you know, you're really excited." I didn't see a home run. Why should I get excited? I don't. And so they had to get one of the pro baseball players out there, and they were throwing pitchers at him. And when he hit a home run, Will went crazy and jumped up and was excited.
But we didn't hear that story until we'd already
had. And George had been suggesting Hoyt Axton, who was a folk singer who was trying to get into TV and movies. And we said, no, Will Brimley is an actor, and you know he'll really be able to deliver. And halfway through the shoot, George would come by the set. We'd basically say, would you please just sort of show up and, you know, give us some moral support? And he looked at us and said, you're the guys who wanted an actor.
Not a singer.
Yeah.
No, Will was very difficult. In fact, anytime you're not seeing his face in the movie, it's not Will Brimley, it's his body double. So all the over-the-shoulder shots and all of the running around outdoors,
he refused to be.
He just said, you know, I've done my bit. If you don't have it, you don't have it. And the last day of shooting with Will, he basically said, I'm not going to do it for the Wheat Brothers. So we had Joe shoot the last sequence, and we shot the stuff with Will, and he said, okay, I'm done. And we said, well, would you just be there for our shots of Nikki? And because it was to help another actor, he said, yeah, I'll do that. But he had already started taking off his hair pieces, and
his beard was still on.
His beard was still on. And we had the cinematographer just sort of pretend to be leaning up against the camera watching the scene without filming it, but actually turning on the camera and running it on it. So we had another shot of Will. So in the coverage of that, Will goes from having hair to not having hair.
But there are also many shots of Will that are other people. The producer, Tom Smith, is Will in one shot. Jim is Will in another shot.
Yeah.
I was the only person who didn't get to play Will.
Well, if they make another Ewok movie, you can do it then.
I just imagine this, like, in a nutshell, Wilford Brimley being, like, Kevin Spacey's impersonation of Walter Matthau for the Star Wars audition tapes that Saturday Night Live did, where he's supposed to be Obi-Wan Kenobi, and he's just, like, walking around being confused and just, like, not wanting to partake in anything that's going on. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
No, I haven't seen that. It sounds interesting. But, you know,
it's awesome.
Will Brimley is, I think, a really good actor, but, you know, he's buddies with Robert Duvall, and he'd just as soon be on his ranch in Utah.
I know you can't answer it for him, but what might his expectation have been?
Well, the only reason he did it, he was initially going to turn it down. We flew out to Utah to meet with him to, you know, say you should do this movie, and he wasn't very interested. But then I guess his grandkids told him, oh, you could be in a Star Wars movie. You've got to do it. And for the first two or three days, he was grumpy, but he wasn't too difficult. And at that point, we had too much in the can. And then he started being extraordinarily difficult, and there was nothing we could do other than start shooting around him.
But I'm still glad we had him in it, because I think, you know, he makes that character
and
fun.
People who don't know that can't really tell, and I don't think it
matters. No. When I was a little kid, he was like your grandpa. I mean, he's like the grandpa hanging out with the Ewoks. This is wild. And one other question I wanted to ask, they were always going to be ABC movie of the weeks. That was the way that these were.
It was like a deal with ABC so that domestically it was shown on TV and then it was released overseas as a feature.
So it did. That's okay. So it was an overseas feature, but it's never played theatrically here unless it's been in like a revival screening or like an illegal showing somewhere.
I don't know of any screenings here other than the cast and crew screening was at the North Point Theater in San Francisco.
And we showed the theatrical version.
Yeah.
Seems like such a missed opportunity for the movie not to have been in theaters, you know, considering the Star Wars craze and, you know.
No, but that was
ABC,
the deal.
Yeah, ABC wanted it as
something.
Now that Disney owns ABC and Star Wars, maybe they can work something out.
Yeah, it would actually be interesting to have it.
I want to see it.
I want to see it.
I want to see it in 3D IMAX.
Yeah, you can pay for the conversion. But it actually was very nicely shot, and
when you go back and watch it, it's real. Like it feels. I mean, again, I don't know what the exact budget was. We can imagine that it wasn't on the same budget that the theatrical films were. The movie feels big.
It was basically about $7 million, a little more than $7 million.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like four times. I mean, like three times that, times that at the time. I mean, like it's unbelievable. Like
George had the studio. He had all the sets. The throne for the Marauder King is a speeder bike that
two speeder bikes
turned on end and then covered with all sorts of extraneous junk. He had the effects crew. He had his own crew that they could shoot as much stuff as they wanted. And we ended up, as we were going through, breaking it into. We had Joe out doing the second unit. We broke the first unit into two units, and Ken would do some shots, and I would be in another part of the forest doing other stuff. And Tom Smith, the producer, went off and shot all the stuff with the trained bird. They basically knew that that was going to be time-consuming, and one of the problems was they had to get the shot of Tarak with the bird on his hand. And they put the mask on the trainer, and when they took the hood off the bird took one look at this marauder face right next to him, and the bird fainted. So
that's when we decided we needed a bird unit.
Yeah, we'll take this a little slower.
Which was actually great for us, because Tom was having a good time.
Yeah, and he was going off and getting great shots.
And not standing over our shoulders at all. So we were just sort of shooting all over the ranch, and there was this redwood forest that was used as an outdoor archery range. And that's anything that's the foresty stuff was done there.
But it was an incredible opportunity for us because we were really nobody. And they basically turned us loose on ILM and said, you can do whatever you want. And amazing talent up there already in place. And then when we came back from doing that, you know, it was are struck by lightning moment. And most people who have any success in Hollywood have that moment where you're just in the right place at the right time.
That's insane. Everything you guys have talked about with the Ewok films have completely surpassed any expectations. Speaking of, this is insane. Thank you guys so much for coming on and talking about this. This has been incredible.
Well, it was our pleasure. It was an important film in our lives, and I'm glad it was an important film in your life, too.
Oh, certainly. I can't even thank you enough. This has been fantastic. I'll tell you what, when the Blu-ray or DVD comes out in that huge Star Wars Disney bundle, I hope you guys will come back and talk to us about it and whatever special features are on it and stuff like that. Because you know it's going to happen. There's no way it won't.
Well, it's money sitting on the table. Somebody has to.
Exactly.
As long as the ratio should be correct, and also if they would do the day for night stuff, which the DP worked very hard on the day for night scenes, and when they released the DVD of it,
they just pumped
everything up so there are day for night scenes that look like day.
And I want them to use my title for the film, which is Endor Beginning.
Oh,
we had a big contest trying to figure out a title for the film.
The original title was what now?
Oh, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was Jim's joke was.
Okay. Like Frank said, I could list 10 movies from my childhood that was a constant source of enjoyment, and this would be on that list of 10. I cannot say thank you enough for coming on and telling us stories, about this, you know, about your career, about Endor, about everything. So, really super cool. And I truly hope that a special edition Blu-ray with a commentary and all the bells and whistles or whatever bells and whistles would be available, you know, in this day and age, finally gets, you know, the light of day. So.
Well, we're just glad that it's finally ended up at Disney. Of all the companies, I think that's a good home, because the Disney films were certainly similar to what the Ewok was to you. The Disney films when we were kids were some of the most exciting things we had ever seen.
It is just it's an honor to talk to you guys about something so big from our childhood. So,
well, thanks for asking us to join you.
Of course.
Absolutely. Hopefully, let's keep in touch, and I'll send you guys the link to the Kevin Spacey audition.
Oh yeah, okay. I would love to see that.
So yeah, thank you again so much for coming on. This has been incredibly wild.
It's been
so
fun.
Thank you guys.
Okay.
Thanks
talk
a lot.
To you sometime in the future.
Sounds great.
We keep in touch. Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Bye bye.